Looking for exciting video content live and on demand? Visit www.voiceamerica.tv for exclusive content you just can't find anywhere else. That's voiceamerica.tv. Tune in now.
The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericahealth.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management. Do you sometimes feel overwhelmed by life's difficulties or a traumatic experience? You are not alone. Welcome to Inspired Journeys, Overcoming Adversity and Thriving with Lisa Ferrance. Today, you'll hear from professionals and everyday people who understand the impact of life's challenges and the personal growth and newfound meaning that can come from the healing journey. Listen, pay it forward, and your life could change too. Now, here is your host, Lisa Ferrance.
Welcome. I'm Lisa Ferrance, and this is Inspired Journeys, Overcoming Adversity and Thriving. I'm delighted that you can join us. The topic for today's program is such an important one because it's an issue that affects countless people across the country, I think both directly and indirectly. We'll be talking about the diagnosis and treatment of depression. You know, they say that sometimes you don't have to look further than your own backyard to find the answers or the resources that you need. And to find the right guest, in fact, the perfect guest for this topic, I did not have to look any further than my living room. My husband, Dr. Kevin Ferrance, is truly a national expert in the treatment of depression in primary care. He received his MD from SUNY at Buffalo School of Medicine, and then he did a family practice residency and fellowship at the University of Maryland. He was there for 24 years, and while he was there, he was the director of student and employee health, he was the director of clinical operations, and he was the residency director. He is now the chief medical officer for Baltimore Medical System, and I am proud to tell you that he has authored more than 36 articles and book chapters focusing on the treatment of depression, as well as smoking cessation, which is his other area of expertise. He has received more than 24 teaching awards, and he has been repeatedly recognized as one of the best family physicians by local and national magazines. And interestingly enough, for 8 years, he hosted a radio show called Sunday Rounds, which was the largest medical call-in show on public radio. And I have the great pleasure, actually, of sharing a lot of my cases with Kevin, and we'll talk a little bit about that collaborative approach to treatment and how effective that is. So, Kevin, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
I am delighted to have you. So, I think it would make sense if we start off by my asking you, who's vulnerable to experiencing a depressive episode? Is this something that anybody can potentially experience?
Oh, indeed. Depression is a ubiquitous illness. It's a very common dysfunction of our brain. I think it, unfortunately, as with all mental illness, it's terribly stigmatized. But
yeah.
As with any illness, it involves something going wrong with the organ involved, and in this case, it's our brain. It's very easy when it's your kidney or your heart or your liver because you can biopsy it and you can look at it pretty easily. But because our brain is behind this thick, bony box and you can't get to it very easily, depression is misunderstood and actually fairly difficult to study.
Hmm. So is there a particular age or a particular time in life when you think that a patient's become more susceptible to a depressive episode?
Yeah, there's no question. Depression tends to occur starting in the 20s and 30s. That's when it's most common, although even little children can be diagnosed with depression, and certainly the elderly also can experience depressive episodes. But it tends to occur in the 20s and 30s. The first episode of depression tends to occur in the 20s and 30s. It tends to be a recurring illness, and so many people who have one episode of depression will unfortunately go on to have another episode of depression. And the more episodes you have, the more likely you are to have yet another subsequent episode of depression. In terms of other people who are at risk, depression runs in families. While there is not yet one gene that's been identified as the cause of depression, we know for sure that there is a genetic component to depression, and that's based on twin studies, because twins, identical twins, have a much higher rate of what we call concordance, that both twins wind up having higher rates of depression than siblings that are not identical twins. So that tells you that there is a genetic component.
And so would that include twins who are not who have not had the same experiences, or who were raised separately or developed depression in adulthood when they were living separate lives?
Yes, it actually does. It has not. It's not dependent on them living together, being raised together. The concordance rate of identical twins in terms of depression is much higher than what's seen in siblings that are not twins.
Okay. So, and you said that the 20s to 30s, that's a particularly vulnerable age.
That appears when most patients have their first episodes of depression. Some definitely earlier, and definitely later. You can have another episode. You can have your first episode later in life, but it tends to occur in the 20s. The first episode tends to occur in the 20s and 30s. The other important biological factor is the sex of the patient, and women are probably twice as likely to have an episode of depression as men. There appears to be something related to having two X chromosomes that increases the likelihood of depression.
Oh, interesting. So what I'm wondering is, when you talk about the 20s to 30s, you're also talking, I think, traditionally about the childbearing years. So that makes me think about this whole issue of postpartum depression.
Yes. So, and you're absolutely right. Women in their childbearing years are without question the most vulnerable population. And there's really a lot of controversy about postpartum depression. It's referred to a lot in the public press. I think there's a general perception that you are more likely to have an episode of major depression in the months following a pregnancy. But several large epidemiological studies have followed women after a pregnancy, and actually there really isn't any significant increase in the likelihood of having a depressive episode, a major depressive episode. There are several other mood disturbances that can occur after a woman has a baby. One is almost universal. It's called the blues. And after 2 or 3 days after you have a baby, sometimes a little bit more, a woman can be very teary and emotional, but doesn't really meet criteria for a major depressive episode. And then there's this terrible disorder of postpartum psychosis, mm-hmm. where I'm sure you've heard many stories. People have all heard stories of women who do kill their children or do terrible things to their children.
Yes,
that is really a psychotic disorder where people really get desperately disturbed, and that, there's no question, is triggered by the pregnancy. And in fact, in subsequent pregnancies, women are at risk again for an episode of postpartum psychosis. But if you match up women who have had a baby and who haven't had a baby, actually the incidence of depression is the same. So it's why there really is no distinct disorder in the textbooks, in the textbook of DSM-IV, that specifically says postpartum depression. And that's because in women who have had depressive episodes after having had a baby, they've looked at every possible factor, every blood test you can imagine, mm-hmm. to try to distinguish an episode of depression after having had a baby and not having had a baby, and they really have never been able to find anything different. You know, you would expect if it was due to the baby, there would be some kind of a hormonal difference, especially.
Right, right.
And there's never been, nothing's ever been found that's shown to be the case. So I try not to use the word postpartum depression. I just say that it's a depressive episode, and the woman just happened to have had a baby.
Hmm. But interesting that you're suggesting that if they've had that experience, when they do have another child, there's an increased vulnerability.
So there is some evidence that if you have had an episode of depression after having had a baby, you may be at increased risk of having another episode with subsequent pregnancies. That is, however, most prevalent in women who have had an episode of postpartum psychosis. That really does recur very frequently.
Okay. So I'm sure you get asked this question all the time. Do we understand from a scientific standpoint why people become depressed?
No. I mean, we know genetics, and we know we definitely know that genetics plays a role, and we know that stressful life events can precipitate an episode of depression. Within 6 months of a significant life event, a significant stressful life event, people are more likely to have a major depressive episode, but the underlying cause of depression remains elusive. There's most of what our theories are about related to the cause of depression are based on how do antidepressants work. And antidepressants, as we'll talk about, raise certain chemicals in our brain, certain neurotransmitters, serotonin, norepinephrine, dopamine. And so the belief was, oh, well, then depression must be caused by some low level of that neurotransmitter or that brain chemical. But actually, a very long time ago, it was shown that while depressed patients can have low levels of serotonin or norepinephrine or dopamine in their blood or in their spinal fluid, once you give them an antidepressant, those levels actually normalize very, very rapidly, usually within hours. And yet, when you take care of patients who are depressed, or you've ever been depressed yourself, you know that after you get put on an antidepressant, it takes weeks and weeks, sometimes months, before
right.
people actually start to feel better. So it's obviously not the level of norepinephrine and serotonin. And what we're really seeing is the downstream effect of something that's going on much more basic in the brain, and we just don't know what that is yet.
So I was going to ask you, are there certain life experiences that are more likely to create a depressive episode?
Well, go ahead.
No, you know, I'm thinking as a clinician working with people who have traumatic experiences in the past, they certainly come in almost always with a diagnosis of an affective disorder. So in my mind, I'm thinking, you know, trauma would perhaps make somebody more vulnerable. I don't know if there are other experiences that you see that you think increase that likelihood.
Well, I mean, we often talk about the depressive symptoms that people get when someone dies, which really we refer to as a separate disorder. It's really what we call bereavement. So certainly if a loved one dies, you can have an episode of depression. But I would say any traumatic life event can precipitate an episode of depression, of major depression, as opposed to what we often refer to as a mood disorder. Sometimes even happy events in a person's life, the birth of a child, the buying of a house, having a new job, those things which from the outside you would think, oh, you know, those are happy life events, mm-hmm. can often precipitate several weeks of feeling sad, but not actually where you reach the point of saying you're having a major depressive episode. So I really think any traumatic life event can precipitate an episode of depression.
You know, you raise a point that I want to stay with for a second, and that is that a lot of people do use the phrase, I'm feeling depressed, or I'm so depressed. They use that, you know, very loosely. I'm thinking, though, that there are times when they're not actually experiencing a major depressive episode. So if it's not depression, you know, what's going on for them?
Well, you're absolutely right. Many people say, oh, I feel so depressed. Well, there are very strict criteria involved in making a diagnosis of a major depressive episode. And being sad for a couple of days is usually not going to be enough to meet that criteria. So why don't we run through the diagnostic criteria. First of all, you have to have a mood disturbance that's pretty significant, and it has to be pretty much every day for at least 2 weeks. So someone who's sad because of a life event, a breakup of a girlfriend, or some financial issue that can have fleeting episodes where they may feel bummed out for a couple of days or even a week, but where it's intermittent, where the symptoms are not consistent, is not going to meet criteria for depression. So you have to have one of two major symptoms in order to meet criteria for a major depressive episode, and it has to be for 2 weeks, at least 2 weeks. One is feeling really sad, down in the dumps, depressed, hopeless, helpless, you know, thinking that the world really is a terrible place. Or you have to have what we call, refer to as anhedonia, where you've stopped having fun. And actually, that's how I ask about anhedonia. I ask my patients, what do you do for fun? And a person with anhedonia says, actually, I don't have any fun. They'll often go on and talk about the things they used to have fun doing, that they used to go shopping, and they used to buy things, and they used to play with their kids, and now they just don't have any fun anymore. So you have to have one of those two things, which really is an interesting thing for patients, because sometimes patients will present, and their only symptom is anhedonia, their only major criteria. So the truth is, you don't have to feel depressed to meet criteria for a major depressive episode. I mean, that's one of those really surprising things for many patients, as I'm sure you know.
Right. So let's take a quick break at this point, and when we come back, I'll talk a little bit more. I want you to talk a little bit more about other symptoms and then some of the assessment tools that are used to help make that diagnosis.
Okay.
We will be right back. Stay with us.
What's going on behind the scenes with your favorite Voice America show or host? For the latest news, visit the iRadio blog at iradioblog.com.
Overcome and transcend trauma with guidance from Lisa Ferrance, president and founder of the Institute for Advanced Psychotherapy Training and Education, and author of the book, Treating Self-Destructive Behaviors in Trauma Survivors. Now in its third printing, Lisa Ferrance's book for clinicians offers creative treatment options, assessment tools, and new ways of understanding self-destructive behavior in trauma survivors. Trauma experts say,
Lisa Ferrance's book is a rare gift to clinicians.
Sound inventive approaches to help clients discover alternative ways to self-soothe, and
far and away the best book written on this complex topic.
Order Lisa Ferrance's book online and receive a 20% discount by visiting www.lisaferrance.com. That's www.lisaferrance.com. If you have a child in your life with autism, there may be a lot of questions that you need answered. What if your child has recently been diagnosed? Or maybe you have a question about treatment that your child is currently undergoing. For answers to these and more, tune into Autism Spectrum Radio. Our guests will include parents and experts to discuss current experiences, treatments, and breakthroughs for those living with autism. Listen every Tuesday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel.
Your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're tuned into Inspired Journeys, Overcoming Adversity and Thriving. To connect with Lisa Ferrance or her guest today, please call 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. Or send an email to lisa@lisaferrance.com. Now, back to Inspired Journeys.
Welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Kevin Ferrance about depression and the treatment of depression. So you had talked right before the break about anhedonia, the loss of interest in things that used to be pleasurable for a person, and feeling down in the dumps, hopeless, helpless. Are there other symptoms that we should be aware of that you are looking for when you're making that diagnosis in your patients?
Absolutely. So you have to have a total of 5 symptoms, actually. One of those 5 symptoms has to be either depressed mood or anhedonia. Then you have to have another 4 symptoms, unless you have both depressed mood and anhedonia, in which case you only need 3. And the other possible symptoms are a change in appetite or weight, which in the old days people used to think that it was always weight loss, that people generally presented with depression with a loss of appetite and losing weight, but actually many patients with depression do present with weight gain.
Right, and I think part of that is that they may be self-medicating with food.
Absolutely.
Okay,
no question
right.
about it. The other is a change in sleep. Mm-hmm. And the classic sleep disturbance in someone who's having a major depressive episode is what we call terminal insomnia, where the person falls asleep okay, and then at 3 o'clock in the morning they wake up and they are completely unable to go back to sleep.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have to be terminal insomnia. It can be trouble falling asleep, it could be trouble staying asleep, or it could be sleeping all the time.
So any sleep disturbance?
Any sleep disturbance is meets criteria for one of those other symptoms for depression.
Okay.
Another symptom is something that the patient sometimes may not even feel themselves, but other people, if they look at them, will notice that the person looks agitated, that their voice is shaking a little bit, or their hands are tremulous, or they're like picking at their clothes. They just seem like they're on edge, or they're talking slow, and they're walking slow, and they're reacting very slowly. And we call that psychomotor agitation or retardation.
So again, you can have opposite presentations, and they'd still be a part of that criteria.
That is correct.
Yeah.
Another symptom is fatigue or loss of energy. Many, many patients, I would say, almost universally, people who are depressed say that they've lost energy. Another symptom is feeling worthless or feeling excessively or inappropriately guilty. It's very common for depressed patients who can't point to an obvious reason why they're feeling depressed to feel as though there's just something wrong with them.
I will add to that I have many clients who feel guilty about being depressed and the impact that depression is having on other members of their family.
Which, of course, it does. You know, parenting behavior is impaired, and your relationships at work, your relationships at home are very often impaired when you're depressed. Another symptom is the decreased ability to concentrate or to make decisions or to think things through. So people can't sit and watch a television show, or they can't do a crossword puzzle. Their mind wanders frequently.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last possible symptom is probably the scariest symptom that people have when they're depressed, which is recurring thoughts of death or dying or feeling like they want to hurt themselves or commit suicide.
Mm-hmm. Can we also add to that list the somatization of it? What happens for them physically? In other words, are they more vulnerable to complaining about more pain on their body when they're depressed? Do you see that?
Yeah, there's no question that many times patients present with depression, but their symptoms are actually manifesting in pain. So people who are depressed may have more headaches, and people who are depressed may have more back pain. They may have pelvic pain or stomach pain, you know, abdominal pain. So pain is a very common presentation as part of a depressive episode.
Mm. And I'm thinking that oftentimes patients are more likely to land in your office before they would land in my office, because that somatic complaint is bringing them in.
Well, not just that. I mean, people don't tend not to seek help for mental illness because of the stigma associated with many patients with mental illness. So
very true.
You're absolutely right. The ticket into my office is usually a somatic complaint. When you see a family physician, you're going to call and say, I have a pain, I have a symptom. And the challenge to family physicians is to try to weed through what looks like a somatic complaint and to actually find the depression that's behind that complaint.
Very important point. I want to also go back to something you said a minute ago that I'm curious about, and that is, do you find that certain cultures are less accepting of the diagnosis of depression? Do men accept the diagnosis less than women? Is that an issue that you see?
Yeah, I would say that from a sex standpoint, a gender standpoint, I mm-hmm. don't see terrible differences in that. I would say that most people in general are resistant to taking on a diagnosis of any sort of a mental illness. I would say there are certain cultures where it's almost impossible to even broach the subject mm. of a mental illness. The Spanish-speaking populations, very common. Asian folks have real difficulty, many have real difficulty addressing the possibility that what they have is a mental illness.
Mm. And that leaves me feeling like then they suffer because they're not willing to if you're not going to accept the diagnosis, obviously you're not going to be open to treatment.
There's no question. And unfortunately, the longer you go with a depressive episode without being treated, the more likely that episode is not going to go away, mm-hmm. and B, the more likely you're going to have future episodes down the road.
That's an important point. So if it goes untreated, there's an increased vulnerability towards subsequent episodes of depression.
There's absolutely no question that unless you get the person better, they have an increased risk of having other episodes of depression.
Mm. All right, let's talk a little bit about some of the assessment tools that are used to make the diagnosis.
So I would say that most mental health professionals wind up using what's called a structured interview, where mm-hmm. the clinician, whether it's a psychiatrist or a clinical social worker or a psychologist, asks the patient questions, asks about those diagnostic criteria that we talked about, and comes up with an assessment of whether or not the patient is depressed. There is, however, another tool that has been taught for, I don't know, probably 10 or 15 years now, and it was a tool that was developed through a very large grant to specifically be used initially by primary care doctors. Luckily, I'm hearing now more and more that it's filtering into the psychiatric community.
Mm-hmm.
And the tool is called a PHQ-9. And the PHQ-9, for people who are listening and who are wondering perhaps they are depressed, the PHQ-9 is readily available at many, many websites on the Internet. And all the PHQ-9 does is it takes all of those symptoms that we initially talked about that are the diagnostic criteria for making an episode, for making the diagnosis of an episode, and it puts a scale on it in terms of how many days in the last 2 weeks have you suffered with these symptoms. And it could be not at all, or several days, or more than half the days, or nearly every day. And then, so each one of those diagnostic questions then has a scale of 0 to 3. So the maximum score that you can have on a PHQ-9 is then 27. And the great thing about using a PHQ-9 as a clinician is it not only tells me whether the patient is depressed, yes or no, but it gives me a clear indication of how depressed is the patient. Are they mildly depressed or moderately depressed or moderately severely depressed or severely depressed? It also allows me on future visits after I put the patient on treatment, it allows me to assess how effective is my intervention. You know, am
right.
I actually making the patient better?
So you get a baseline, and then as you are administering that in subsequent visits, you're seeing if there's been movement in up or down, hopefully down, right? The number is getting smaller.
Down.
Right.
Yeah, hopefully down. And then it gives me guidance as to whether I need to change my intervention. Is the medication working? Do I need to give more medication? Do I need to give different medication? So Very, very wonderful tool for for clinicians to use.
And I will say very, very easy and quick to administer, which is nice.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm wondering if people sometimes confuse depression with other affective disorders like bipolar or dysthymia. Can you talk just a little bit about those disorders?
Certainly. So there's a general perception that bipolar disorder is probably being overdiagnosed at this point.
I'm seeing that for sure.
So just to think, epidemiologically, and we didn't talk numbers at the beginning of the show, roughly 7% of the population in any one year will experience a major depressive episode. And over a lifetime, it's almost 1 in 5 people. It's about 17% of people will have an episode of depression. In terms of the epidemiology of bipolar disorder, it's unipolar depression, one-sided depression, is actually about 10 times as frequent. So way, way, way fewer people actually have bipolar disorder than have unipolar depression. So there's two kinds of bipolar disorder. There's bipolar 1, and in bipolar 1, people have mostly what are called manic episodes. And in a manic episode is a very dramatic thing for someone to have. It's when the person has marked impairment. The person, anyone around them will say, there's something really seriously going on with this person. They're not sleeping. They're talking all the time. They're spending money that they don't have. They're incredibly busy and doing lots and lots of stuff. It has to last for at least a week. And as I said, they're markedly impaired. And then sometimes people with bipolar 1 will occasionally have an episode of depression. But the overwhelming mood disturbance in a patient with bipolar 1 are manic episodes.
Okay.
The other kind of bipolar disorder is bipolar 2. Bipolar 2 patients are mostly depressed, but every once in a while they'll have what's called a hypomanic episode, which is an episode lasting for at least 4 days that has some of the symptoms of a manic episode, but they're not severely impaired. These are people who are still going to work. Their coworkers, their family may wonder, wow, what's going on? You know, this person doesn't seem like their normal self, but they're not severely impaired, so they don't think, you know, we got to bring him to the ER.
Right.
You know, we got to bring this person to the ER because they really, really look like they're impaired. Those episodes, those hypomanic episodes, can actually last from weeks to months. And the funny thing is that many patients with bipolar 2 actually don't want to treat their hypomanic episodes.
Yeah, they say they feel more creative, more energized.
They're painting, they're doing all kinds of stuff that they weren't doing when they weren't hypomanic and certainly weren't doing when they were depressed. So those are the two kinds of bipolar disorder, but there's no question that unipolar, just major depressive episodes, are way more common than bipolar 1 or bipolar 2.
And if you can, just say something briefly about dysthymia.
So dysthymic patients have a chronic low level of depression. They tend not to get to the point where many of them don't seek treatment because they just see that that's sort of who they are. They have mm-hmm. almost like a personality disorder, that they're just always a little bit sad. People who always see the glass half full. People who just can't seem to have a whole lot of pleasure in their lives, but not to the point where somebody says, we really need to take you to the doctor because you're really not doing very well. And dysthymia can last for years left untreated. And unfortunately, the treatment of it is also almost lifelong with antidepressants. There are also some people who have what's called double depression. And those are patients who are dysthymic, who always walk around with this low-grade depression, and then who also may tip over into major depressive episodes as well. And then they usually go seek treatment when they're more severely depressed.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I want us to begin to talk about treatment, because I know that for our listeners, that's such an important part of this conversation. So we will be right back. Stay with us.
Be sure to friend us on Facebook. You can do it right now. Visit facebook.com/Voice America or search for us at keyword Voice America.
Are you looking for a 21st century first aid kit? You don't have to suffer nor take on the increasing expense of healthcare. Tune in to Good Vibrations. Catch the wave to better health. Your host, Lynn Waldrop, will show you how many common and even uncommon aches, pains, and ills can be remedied through sound, color, and light. While it may sound like these are new concepts, believe it or not, these are actually ancient methods that still make sense today. Create a healthy life. Listen Tuesdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific on Voice America Health and Wellness.
Overcome and transcend trauma with guidance from Lisa Ferentz, president and founder of the Institute for Advanced Psychotherapy Training and Education, and author of the book, Treating Self-Destructive Behaviors in Trauma Survivors. Now in its third printing, Lisa Ferentz's book for clinicians offers creative treatment options, assessment tools, and new ways of understanding self-destructive behavior in trauma survivors. Trauma experts say,
Lisa Ferentz's book is a rare gift to clinicians.
Sound inventive approaches to help clients discover alternative ways to self-soothe. And
far and away the best book written on this complex topic.
Order Lisa Ferentz's book online and receive a 20% discount by visiting www.lisaferentz.com. That's www.lisaferentz.com.
Your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're tuned into Inspired Journeys, overcoming adversity and thriving. To connect with Lisa Ferentz or her guest today, please call 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. Or send an email to lisa@lisaferentz.com. Now, back to Inspired Journeys.
Welcome back. We've been talking with Dr. Kevin Ferentz about depression, and we're going to now focus on issues related to treatment. Kevin, what I wanted to ask you is that I know so many of our listeners are going to relate to this. There are so many commercials on television now that tout all these different antidepressant medications. So I guess my first question about that, as a physician, do you think direct-to-consumer marketing is a good thing?
No, I personally am desperately opposed to direct-to-consumer marketing.
Yeah, oh, tell us about that.
Yeah, direct-to-consumer marketing is very unfair because it can't possibly paint a clinically valid picture for patients. Obviously, the pharmaceutical industry sees it as a boon because even though they have to say all of these terrible things about their product,
the fact
that they're getting the name of their product out to the consumer, where it's not just the physician who gets the opportunity to decide what medication the person goes on. Mm-hmm. Now, the patient can walk into the room and say, hey, you know, I've heard really good things about this antidepressant, and I'd like to try it. And so the physician loses a little bit of their authority, but I've never been a fan of direct consumer advertising. I think it scares patients more than it really helps them to learn about the different meds.
When you listen to that disclaimer at the end, and it's usually done in a lower voice very, very quickly, but they rattle off, you know, the 30 horrible things that could happen to you if you take the medication, what I find is that people become even more hesitant and reluctant. And I think as it is, people are reluctant to start an antidepressant medication. Do you find that in your practice?
Absolutely, completely. The other thing is that the only products that are being advertised are the brand name products. And at this point, most of the antidepressants we've been using for the last 20 years are now available generically. And for most patients, they actually don't need a brand name antidepressant anyway. They can use a generic, and they're perfectly safe and effective.
And I'm assuming that generics would be much less expensive as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
If people do have to pay out of pocket.
Yeah. So are all, you know, there's all these brands and names that are out there. Are all antidepressant medications alike? And how do you know as a physician, how do you know which ones to prescribe?
Well, that's an excellent question. Part of it has to do with, has the patient responded to an antidepressant in the past? Obviously, if a person's been on Prozac or been on Zoloft or been on Paxil in the past and have done well, then that's the first drug that you're always going to go to if the patient has a subsequent episode of depression. Another thing to ask is if a family member has ever responded to an antidepressant, because there's literature that would say that if you have a loved one who has responded to an antidepressant, then genetically you're probably also at increased chance of responding to that antidepressant.
Is the opposite true, that if a patient comes in and says, my mother did horribly on a particular med, that you would be less likely to prescribe that one?
So I would probably be less likely to do it, only because it would be like a placebo effect kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think if the person suspects or has bad feelings about a drug, I think they're likely to have an adverse effect from it.
So, okay.
But no, I don't think scientifically it's valid, but but that's sort of where the art of medicine comes in. So I would, if a person said, oh, no, my mother did terrible on that, why would I subject the patient to the angst of trying to try that medication?
Right. Makes sense. Okay. Can we just talk briefly about giving medication to pregnant women?
Sure. So pregnancy, if you're depressed in a pregnancy, it actually has very adverse effects on the pregnancy. Women are less attached to the baby in utero. The pregnancy outcomes are worsened if a person is significantly depressed. And so, you know, physicians have to often do what we call a risk-benefit analysis. And for most patients who are depressed, the risk-benefit analysis falls on the side of treating the pregnancy with medications. Most antidepressants are perfectly safe to use in pregnancy. Mm-hmm. There are several of them that we avoid, but most of them are safe to use in pregnancy. The caveat is the one, you know, thing that you think about is, we like to try to avoid giving a pregnant woman any medication for the first 10 or 11 weeks of the pregnancy, because that's when the baby is developing. After 12 weeks or so, it's a completely formed baby. And if you need to give the patient an antidepressant, usually it's safer for you to give the patient an antidepressant than it is for them to be significantly depressed during the pregnancy.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Okay. So I don't even know if there's probably not one answer to this question. What I'm thinking of asking is, what's the usual course of response to medication? I don't know that there is a usual course, but what should a doctor do if a patient isn't responding sufficiently to their medication?
So actually there is an answer to your question. If you take all antidepressants, all of them work about 60 to 70% of the time. No matter which antidepressant you pick, about 60 to 70% of patients will respond, assuming you give the patient an adequate dose of that antidepressant. And that's sort of what your question is implying, is if you see a patient who's depressed, you put them on an antidepressant, within a couple of weeks, you should start to see some response. And so it's important for patients to have a PHQ-9, as we mentioned before, that every time they're seen, a PHQ-9 should be administered to see if that score is dropping and that the patient's getting better. If the patient's not getting better, the first intervention is usually to increase the dose. Most antidepressants have a range of therapeutic dosing. And so if a person doesn't respond to the starting dose, then you'll go to a higher dose, usually doubling. And then if the person's not better, potentially doubling again. So if by 4 to 6 weeks of being on an antidepressant at a very reasonable dose, there's not a lot of response, then actually what the clinician mostly does is change the antidepressant, because it didn't work.
Right.
And there are enough of them on the market that if one fails, you have many others to choose from.
Okay. As we talk about medication and the way that patients respond, can you talk a little bit about the difference between response versus remission? Because I know that there's a difference. I'd like our listening audience to be educated about that.
Sure. So this gets back to, again, the PHQ-9 score. And what it's about is, What you want to do when you put a person on an antidepressant, you don't just want them to feel better, you want them to feel normal. And we refer to a decrease in the PHQ-9 score. If the PHQ-9 score is cut in half, then by definition, the person has actually responded to the antidepressant. But it's actually getting their PHQ-9 score down to 4 or less, which is normal, which is really what we want to get to, and that's called remission. So you can imagine that if a patient came in who is really, really depressed, who had, let's say, a PHQ-9 score of 25, which is really very severely depressed, and you put them on medication, and then you see the patient back, and 4 to 6 weeks later, the person is now at a score of 13. So it's dropped dramatically, but in actually, a score of 14, 13 or 14, is the person still moderately depressed.
Right.
And so that's not good enough, and so you still have to intervene. You have to change meds. You have to add different meds. You have to up the dose. And so the literature says, the medical literature says that unless you get to remission, which is a PHQ-9 of less than 5, you're actually more at risk for having another episode of depression. So it really is very important to get to patients to remission.
Good. I really want our listeners to hear that. I want doctors to hear it. I want clinicians to hear it and patients to hear it, because what I find so often in my practice is that people have some response to their medication and they're just sort of kept at the same dose for very, very long periods of time. And yet, as you say, they're not normal. And when you do the PHQ-9, they're still depressed.
Yep.
So
it's unnecessary.
Yeah. So we've talked a little bit about the fact that people are, I think, fundamentally skittish about taking an antidepressant. And I know that I come in contact, I'm sure you do as well, with a lot of patients who want to take a more holistic or homeopathic approach. What are your professional thoughts about those options?
So there is some evidence that the most widely used supplement that's out there that people wind up taking, which is St. John's wort. The chemical in St. John's wort is called hypericum. So that it is effective in mild depression. But once you get above any mild depression, and most patients who seek care for depression have moderate to moderately severe depression, not mild depression, mm-hmm. that St. John's wort is actually not effective. The more important thing, however, is the supplement industry in America is completely unregulated. And so there are many studies that have taken bottles of St. John's wort off the shelf, and actually there may be no St. John's wort in it, or there may be much more St. John's wort in it than they've said there was. And because these supplements are often made in overseas, in China and in India, there is zero regulation. And so I believe that it is actually a dangerous thing for people to do. Also, St. John's wort does have many drug interactions that's associated with it. It certainly is no better than any standard antidepressant, and at least you know what you're taking when you take a pharmaceutical product.
Right. So regulated versus completely not regulated is a pretty significant difference.
That is correct.
Yeah. So this may be somewhat of a loaded question given what I do for a living, but what role do you think psychotherapy plays in the treatment of depression?
So I would say that certainly the more significant an episode of depression that a person has, the literature supports not just pharmacology, psychopharmacology, but that the more depressed a person is, the better they do with a combination of meds and psychotherapy. Certainly, mildly depressed patients can go for therapy. Therapy will be helpful. It tends to take a little bit longer than using medication. Certainly, patients who have had multiple episodes of depression, just learning to live with recurring depression, I think warrants a referral for psychotherapy. And the other intervention is exercise. In mild depression, exercise has actually been shown to be just as good as meds.
So for the release of endorphins. for the release of endorphins.
Correct. It's another option for people.
Yeah. So if a patient has tried a lot of different medications and they're just not getting better, what other treatment options are available to them?
So there's a couple. One of them is unfortunately has a very bad rap, and needlessly has a very bad rap, and that's ECT. So ECT is electroconvulsive therapy, and I think because of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, people think that it is a barbaric sort of intervention. It is nothing like what it looks like in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. People are actually not seizing on the outside. They're only seizing on the inside. But it does cause a seizure. It does. And what happens when you have a seizure is you get this flood of these neurotransmitters into your brain. And so the best I can, the best analogy I've used with patients is that it's like rebooting your computer. There is no question whatsoever that ECT is the single most effective treatment we have for severe depression. More than 80% of patients will respond to ECT. And while people always talk about the memory loss, the memory loss is, it's short-term memory loss. You may not remember what you had for breakfast this morning, but you're not going to forget where you live, and you don't forget your Social Security number, and you don't forget your kids' names. And when you've gotten to the point where you have failed multiple meds and you don't have a whole lot of other things to offer, ECT is something that all people should keep in the back of their minds as another option for severely depressed patients who aren't getting better. There's another relatively new technique called transcranial magnetic stimulation. It is approved by the FDA. Unlike ECT, it doesn't require anesthesia. It's a completely outpatient procedure where magnets are put on your head and they stimulate brain cells. And it's a daily treatment, 5 days a week for 6 weeks. And up to about 50% of people will respond to that treatment.
So I appreciate your sharing that, because anything that we can do to lessen the stigma about those kinds of treatments, particularly when you're saying they are so effective, you know, we want to take that stigma away from the equation.
Yeah.
In the minute that we have left, I guess the message that I want us both to be able to leave our listening audience with is that although we know that depression is very, very debilitating and certainly can impact many arenas of a person's life, they deserve help. There is help available, and we encourage them to seek that help out.
Absolutely.
Dr. Ferenc, thank you so, so much for sharing your wisdom with us. Thank you to our listening audience, and I please invite you to join us next week, where I will be talking to Dr. Janet Sassoon-Ejet about the impact that bullying has on children. Be well. Take good care of yourselves. See you again soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Inspired Journeys, Overcoming Adversity and Thriving. Please join Lisa Ferenc again next Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. May the next week be a positive, life-changing one for you. Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericahealth.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.